versus Brock, Brock and Brock Confections, Inc.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Robert Zielinski of Ross and Hardy's, representing the appellant, Michael Blakely. This is a Title VII in Section 1981 case alleging race discrimination and termination, as well as retaliation for having filed an EEOC charge during the pendency of the employment. The lower court ruled, we believe erroneously, that Mr. Blakely was incapable of even making out a prima facie case. What, in my opinion, the district court did was take some loose language in some Seventh Circuit cases and apply it in a manner that could never have been intended, because to do so would really suborn Supreme Court precedent and pretty much kill most Title VII cases, if not all. Especially what the district court said was she took the allegations that had made against and by the company against Mr. Blakely regarding his supposed conduct and took them at face value as if they were gospel truth, and then said to show a prima facie case, Mr. Blakely had to point out specific individuals who were identically situated to him, who weren't black, who didn't get fired. Now, I agree that kind of evidence would make a compelling case of racial discrimination. In fact, I think it would be enough to uphold the verdict by itself. However, that's not what the prima facie case is about, and nor the way the prima facie case has been interpreted since it was invented in McDonnell Douglas versus Green. The whole point of the McDonnell Douglas for Dean allocations of proof is specifically to allow a plaintiff, because of the slippery issues of motivation involved, to prove his case without specific evidence tying the demographic factor to the actual decision made. So the judge, by requiring that at this early stage of the case, specifically refusing to consider the massive evidence that the reasons stated by the plaintiff were entirely made up, sort of doubly handicapped Mr. Blakely. She said, you've got to do it in this specific way, and I'm not even going to consider all the evidence that this is a pure pretext that's been made up by Brock and his counsel after the fact. So I think that's entirely inconsistent with any reasonable reading of McDonnell Douglas. It sort of, I guess, in a sense, takes Sanderson, which discredited the pretext plus theories that the Fifth Circuit and the Second Circuit and a couple other circuits were following, and sort of gets around that problem by putting the pretext, the plus, back into the prima facie case rather than into the pretext phase. So I don't think there's any way to reconcile this, the district court decision, with St. Mary's Honor Center and Sanderson versus Reeves Plumbing, or Reeves versus Sanderson Plumbing. I'm sorry, I got that one backwards. Similarly, with the retaliation issue, the court said, well, yeah, it's true, Mr. Blakely filed the charge in early November. It's true that his boss found out about it on November 23rd. It's true that 7 weeks later, despite some time off for Thanksgiving and a one-week Christmas shutdown, they managed to fire Mr. Blakely on January 11th. And it's true that in the interim, the company consciously decided not to give Mr. Blakely a review that had been promised of his performance for December 1. It's also true that the man who ultimately fired Mr. Blakely created this massive document, a five-page, single-spaced document, supposedly outlining all his thoughts about Mr. Blakely's performance. And in the course of doing so, specifically said things that he knew were not true and were unfavorable to Mr. Blakely about Mr. Blakely's performance. Interestingly, when I asked Mr. Jalub, the author of that memo, gee, why'd you write it, Mr. Jalub? He said, I don't know. And when I pushed him, he said, oh, it was for information. Well, information for what purpose and to whom? He said, I don't know. Okay. The district court said, well, that's just suspicious timing because the memo doesn't itself reference Mr. Blakely's charge. Well, that's a requirement for smoking gun evidence. I mean, no one from the company has explained. The author of the memo can't explain why he wrote it. The person who received the memo can't explain why, if that she asked him to write it, she had asked him to write it. It's this big mystery out there. And when you couple it with the fact that it contains known falsehoods adverse to Mr. Blakely, it's pretty compelling evidence that something funny is going on here. And then you roll up to the day he's actually fired, and what happens? He comes into work. Now, interestingly, though, despite the fact that the company has constantly said that Mr. Blakely was fired for a sustained pattern of continuing poor performance, Mr. Jalub, the man who made the decision, despite having written this memo on December 23rd, says never once that it even crossed his mind to terminate Mr. Blakely for poor performance or to indeed even submit some lesser sanction, like a probationary period or a formal corrective action warning. Well, how can somebody be motivated by a sustained pattern of poor performance when that person admits that the thought of terminating based on that behavior never even flickered through his mind, let alone that he seriously considered it, or that's why he did what he did? So in that sense, we've got pretty significant evidence of pretext. It's almost a direct admission that the person who made the decision on behalf of the company...
When was this document written? How long after?
The document was written essentially 3 to 4 weeks after that Mr. Jalove found out about the charge. He became aware of the charge November 23. The memo's dated December 23, and Mr. Jalove's testimony was that he drafted the memo in the 1 or 2 days preceding.
Well, would it be unusual for one of his superiors to say, as long as it's been filed, let's document what the facts are from our point of view?
Well, that might or might not be.
Wouldn't that be good business practice?
It might be, but that's not why Mr. Jalove said he did it. Okay, the company has offered the suggestions on brief that he did it to help inform the company's response to the charge. Well, Mr. Jalove specifically denied being asking to be given to support the company's response to the charge, and the company's response to the charge was filed before Mr. Jalove even started writing this memo. So the facts certainly don't support that interpretation. The other thing that's been suggested is, gee, it wouldn't be unusual for Mr. Jalove to do something like this. Well, neither Mr. Jalove nor anybody else has testified that that's the case. There isn't another memo about an employee like this, and particularly not one that contains self-conscious falsehoods about Mr. Blakely's performance. So it's a huge question as to why it's out there. Then what happens next? December 23rd, the plant shuts down for Christmas vacation. Everybody comes back January 4th. It's a huge blizzard. Mr. Blakely is one of the people who got into work as opposed to missed the whole day. And a week later, they come to Mr. Blakely and say, gee, you were late that day. You have to give us back a half day of vacation or you won't get paid for it. Now, Mr. Blakely's a salary-exempt employee. Under federal law and under the company policies, he's not to be docked for less than full day absences. Mr. Jalove admits he knew that, and everyone else connected with it admits they knew that. And nonetheless, they make this demand to Mr. Blakely. Now, what's really most significant in all of this is if you look at the response we made to their proposed statement of facts, and you look at their brief, all the facts that they're arguing were undisputed, that the district court relied on and should have relied on, were very specifically disputed in our response. I mean, not just with nonsense, but with specific citations to definite testimony that outlined why those facts were in dispute. There were so many factual disputes in this case, there's simply no way that summary judgment could be appropriate, and it needs to be resolved by a jury who can weigh the credibility issues. If you have no questions, I'll reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, I'm Gregory Malavance, representing the Appley Brock's Confections. At the beginning of counsel's argument, he accuses the lower court of basing the summary judgment on taking loose language concerning the standard for a prima facie case from some Seventh Circuit cases. I suggest that that is not at all accurate. To the contrary, the lower court very carefully articulated the four factors that need to be established to establish a prima facie case. And as we have cited in our brief, in at least five cases decided since this case was decided by the lower court, the Seventh Circuit has articulated precisely the same standard for what must be established to establish a prima facie case. I can't see how that could in any way be suggested to be loose language from the cases. To the contrary, we all know how this court goes about its business in saying these are the things that have to be established for a prima facie case to be proven by the plaintiff. And in each of the cases that we cite in our brief, the fourth prong is exactly the same as what the district judge said was not established here, and that is that there has to be some showing that people outside of the protected class were treated more favorably than the plaintiff. Now, notably, despite what everything counsel said today and in his brief, There is absolutely no dispute in this record whatsoever that there is no showing, absolutely no showing, and no attempt to show that anyone outside of the protected class was treated more favorably than Mr. Blakely. And therefore, if this court agrees with what the standard has been and as articulated by this court in the cases cited in our brief, if the court agrees that is the proper standard, as this court consistently has held, then there really is no basis for this appeal to go any further, because plaintiff does not even attempt to say that there's any evidence that that fourth prong has been met. His argument on this appeal is that's the wrong standard, and that is simply not what the cases say. With respect to the claims that there are disputes over material facts, we suggest to the court that this case, as in so many cases, there are facts and there are facts and there are facts. Most fundamentally, as the district court held, with respect to the facts that are truly material to why this individual was discharged, there are no disputed facts. This man was instructed to show up at a meeting on January 11th, the day of his termination. And there's no suggestion that the company was not entitled to have this meeting. To the contrary, the purpose of the meeting was to try yet again, despite having numerous meetings, to try to correct this this individual's performance deficiencies. And let's keep in mind, this man was only an employee of the company for about 9 or 10 months. The same individuals who terminated him were the people who recommended that he be hired and, in fact, hired him. Mr. Blakely himself, in his deposition, says he had a very good relationship with Mr. Jalove and his immediate supervisor, Mr. Schroeder, when he was first hired. Mr. Blakely's deposition in itself presents all of the facts that clearly are undisputed because it comes from his own testimony with respect to what happened in his very short tenure of employment. Mr. Blakely, in his deposition, says that even before his written performance evaluation, Mr. Schroeder, his immediate supervisor, came to him on numerous occasions and specifically cited problems and deficiencies in his performance, all well before he had any desire or intention or actual filing of an EEOC charge. His written performance evaluation in early September documents those very same performance deficiencies. Mr. Blakely, in his deposition, acknowledges that his supervisor went through each and every one of these performance problems in the conference that he had about his evaluation. All of this was done before he filed an EEOC charge. Mr. Blakely, in his deposition, also admits that after his written performance evaluation, Mr. Schroeder, his direct supervisor, came to him and specifically pointed out on a number of occasions that he was making exactly the same types of mistakes. So is there suspicious timing? Is there anything that jumps out of this record that suggests that only because this individual filed an EEOC charge, that all of a sudden what once had been a good relationship now deteriorated? Quite the contrary. By Mr. Blakely's own testimony in his deposition, he had performance problems right from the very beginning. The same problems continued in his performance evaluation. The same problems continued after his performance evaluation. So what happened when January 11th came? The company made yet one more effort to try to sit down with this man and say, we've got to get to the bottom of this. We've got to have you commit to solving this problem. Instead of doing that, what did the plaintiff do? He gets up. In his mind, he says, well, this meeting's over. I'm going to walk out of here. He is specifically warned. And again, this is in his own deposition. He is told, if you leave this meeting, it will be considered insubordination. Despite that, he gets up and leaves. There is no dispute in this record, and the only evidence in this record is that Brock, as an employer, does not condone insubordination, that when someone is insubordinate, they are terminated. The only evidence in this record consistently says that when you do this, you are terminated. As such, either in terms of the fourth prong of a prima facie case, or whether you consider it part of the second prong in terms of meeting the employer's legitimate expectations, or whether you consider it to be an articulation of a legitimate and non-discriminatory reason, it all comes out the same. The bottom line is that this man, despite his performance problems, was insubordinate and consistent with the way Brock treats these situations. This man was terminated. And as such, the summary judgment was entirely proper.
Thank you, counsel. You have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me respond to a couple of points. First, this notion that there's no evidence that anyone who wasn't black wasn't treated better is wrong, because the evidence shows that Mr. Jalal, the person who fired Mr. Blakely, thought his performance was good enough to maintain his employment. It did not justify termination. He told them in the meeting on the 11th, I want you to continue in my employment. Okay?
And why did he walk out of that meeting?
Well, because, again, this is part of the highly disputed fact.
After he was told not to.
What happened at the meeting was this. They come in. Mr. Blakely isn't told his performance is bad. He's told he's getting new duties that he didn't previously do. The duties are explained. The duties are discussed. They go back and forth about the duties.
But why did he walk out of the
meeting? Well, Jalal says to him, do you understand the duties and are you willing to do the job? Mr. Blakely says, yeah, I do understand the duties and I will do my best on the job. Mr. Jalal, by his own admission, then turns the meeting over to Mr. Blakely and says, do you want to talk about your harassment and discrimination allegations? And Mr. Blakely says, no, I don't. I don't feel comfortable discussing those without my lawyer present. That's what Jalal and Blakely both testify to. He then gets up and he starts to exit the room. Now, according to Mr. Jalal, there was nothing else to discuss. Okay? As he's leaving the room, somebody barks at him to sit down in a voice usually that you would use for a disobedient dog. Mr. Blakely was tense at the meeting. He turned back. He came back into the room, and he waited. And no one said anything. They all just sat there staring at each other because both Jalove and Donnellan admitted there was nothing further they actually had to say to the guy. Okay? So this whole meeting comes up on a pretext, on a whim, on what the company knows is an illegitimate demand. According to half the witnesses who attended the meeting, the insubordination occurred when Mr. Blakely got belligerent and started yelling and walked out in mid-sentence on Mr. Jalal. Mr. Jalal says that never happened. That conduct never occurred. And he's the guy who made the termination decision according to the record. So how can there be insubordination when the specific act that's alleged to be insubordinate, according to the decision maker, never even happened? The problem is the company took a position, tried to explain its decision, and its key witness just didn't back him up. The specific testimony wholly rebuts what the company has always said are the reasons for which it acted. And that, according to the Supreme Court, is enough to infer discrimination. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.